Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. This week, we take a look at media across our region, the risks that reporters go to, and the new challenges emerging as repressive regimes meet online surveillance, and documentaries that are determined to create change. Also, a former child soldier from Thailand shares his story. And we turn to Afghanistan, where rivers are running dry as the impacts of climate change are being felt. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. Have you ever watched a documentary and felt like you really got to know the characters and then wondered what happened to them after? If the documentary had an impact on their lives or not? Well, a Jakarta-based initiative is setting out to make sure that documentaries don't just leave you with a nice or a troubled feeling. Good Pitch wants to convert those feelings into social change. I caught up with the team behind Filipino documentary, Audio Perpetua, to find out more about the project.
People call me back home as Carol Katakutan. Katakutan in Filipino means frightened or scared.
Is there any truth in that name?
I always say that you better be scared of me because, I'm quite a tough person.
Dressed in a pastel purple cardigan and with a warm smile overtaking her face. When I met her in Jakarta recently, Carol didn't seem very scary. But I did get the feeling that if she put her mind to something, she'd be formidable. Carol's at the centre of a documentary, currently in production, about people with vision impairments in the Philippines. She also tells me that she has a one-of-a-kind claim. She's the only blind person in the Philippines who has ever written scripts for television.
It's a very visual medium, right? Mm. So it's like a blind telling a story to someone with sight. And I already wrote 3 television scripts and 2 romance novels, which were published. But when I got involved in our organization, you know, it's a calling, it's a mission. So I gave up on all of that.
These days, Carol dedicates her time to Atrieve, a Manila-based organization that trains people with vision impairments to use computers and technology. Their aim is to equip visually impaired people with the skills that will get them professional work and give them the means to live independently.
When we started training blind people on computers, you know, a lot of opportunities were opened which were not there before. Like, you cannot imagine blind people as programmers. Now we have junior programmers, we have software developers. These are all our graduates. We have call center agents, we have transcriptionists, we have virtual assistants. So these opportunities wouldn't have been available to them without the technology that they learned from Atrieve.
The Philippines is one of the world's call center capitals, with 1.2 million people working in the industry. That means there's plenty of jobs in service and tech. But having the skills to get a job is just the first hurdle to overcome. Companies are often reluctant to employ people with vision impairments. And even when they do, they're not always treated equally.
Some people are not that patient with visually impaired people. They feel that some are very patronizing of them and they don't want to feel like that. I mean, mm-hmm. You don't have to patronize me. I can do my job, basically. So there's those difficulties.
That's Ivy Baldoza. She's currently making the documentary film called Audio Perpetua, which follows the trainees at Atrieve. The film's producer, Melanie Atuna, explained.
Actually, it's always a question that is asked to us. Why will we hire people with disabilities when we can hire people that are very able, right? And so this documentary is important because we wanted to show and create this kind of awareness that you can hire people with disabilities.
After 3 years of filming and production, the documentary is now in its final stages. But Melanie says she won't be content just to release the film and hope for the best. So Ivy and Melanie have partnered with Jakarta-based initiative Good Pitch, a not-for-profit initiative that facilitates funding and links to help incite change through film.
And we want to provide sensitivity workshops for the sighted people so that they know how to deal with people who are visually impaired. We wanted to educate employers on how to hire visually impaired people and how to deal with them when they're in a professional environment. We want to create awareness, so screenings, more screenings in schools. We are looking for tech and gadget support.
And Melanie says they're making sure the film won't be off limits to those who feature in it.
Apart from making the documentary, we are doing an audio description of the film to make this an extraordinary experience for them. Audio description meaning we will have a voice talent describe with feelings all the scenes happening, and then you cut it in the sound bites from the subjects. And so even without seeing it, it's going to be an experience for them.
As for Carol, she says it's an honour to be in the film, even if being shadowed by a film crew on and off for 2 years was a little strange at times. It might have got in the way of her movement, but it certainly didn't get in the way of her formidable style.
We always tell them that, oh, you better get out of the way of the blind, otherwise we might run over your camera. So just be careful, you know.
For Asia Calling, I'm Nicole Kirby in Jakarta. Across the world, tens of thousands of child soldiers are forced to join armies and rebel militias every year. Vulnerable and exposed to atrocity, the experience is deeply scarring and traumatic for anyone involved. This week, a former child soldier from Thailand looks back at his time in the jungles along the Cambodian border in the early 1950s. Our correspondent Kanika Pechkau has his story and his extraordinary path to redemption.
Ampon's mother died when he was just 5 years old. At the time, he didn't even know what death was. In his faded memory, there are two things that he remembers most. The way his mother always smelled of jasmine, and the lullaby she often sang. Ampon's father had died a year earlier, and after his mother passed, he was left alone. Orphaned, he started sleeping on the streets of Surin, a border town in northeast Thailand, begging and stealing to get by. In 1951, at the age of 15, Ampon tried to escape the shame and indignity. He followed a stranger he met at the wet market who told him how he could eat 3 meals a day. That's how Ampon ended up as a child soldier in the jungles that line the Thai-Cambodian border. Young and desperate, he found himself fighting alongside the Cambodians in their last-ditch effort to defeat the French. It was a decision, Ampon says, he felt forced to make.
Fighting with others that we do not know, not our enemy, is something strange for us now. But because of the poverty and hardship, I have to do it for my own survival.
Now at the age of 80, Ampon is one of few former child soldiers from that time who is still alive. Looking back, he says the fighting was totally senseless.
There's no reason for me to go out fighting others. It's just a matter of necessity for survival of my own life. That's why I become a child soldier. We go out and fight just for money. That's it.
When I met Ampon in Bangkok, he told me he cried when he first killed. But after a while, killing became part of his daily life. They were paid about $5 for each enemy soldier they killed.
If we attack one person, you know, we can have 100 or 200 baht. That's it.
So you have to attack people to
we have
money.
To attack the people, you know. I go to fight, but we have to really fight and get the outcome, you know. How many people we can attack, how many people wounded, or how many people we can kill, and so forth. You know.
Do you remember how many people you have killed from him?
I can't remember. And I do not want to reveal this because it's a very sad story. We killed people, unknown people, you know, for no reason at all.
In Ampuan's unit, there were 20 young boys. They patrolled day and night along the border with guns and knives ready to attack. Out there, it was a different reality, says Ampuan.
As a child soldier, are you allowed to cry?
Because of the childhood, I have no fear. Especially when we get wounded, you know. It's just out there, just to kill the mad dog, you know.
Like a wooden dog, Ampuan left the jungle when the war was over. Aged 17, he was severely damaged, both physically and mentally. Today his arm doesn't swing freely from injuries sustained in the jungle, and there are 2 bullets still embedded in his stomach. But the physical pain was just one part. Ampuan was haunted by nightmares and riddled with shame.
I have no hope. I tried to make suicide twice. First time I hang, later on I drink insecticide and was out for 5 days now, from midnight of Sunday until the Friday.
Looking back, Ampuan says that young poor children with no guidance could easily be lured into the same nightmare.
For those children, you know, very easy to lure them to the fighting, you know. If they are in very hardship and they have nothing to eat and they have no progress and have no income. So the society have to understand their situation.
It's the reason that later in life, Ampuan was inspired to start the Foundation for Rehabilitation and Development of Children and Family, or FODEC, an organization working for poor children in Thailand. Ampuan used his retirement money to set up the fund, which provides education to thousands of orphans and poor children. Illiterate when he left the jungle, Ampuan struggled through his trauma and managed to go back to school. He spent years working in the church Raya Valley before making the switch into NGOs and eventually obtaining a master's degree. Getting an education changed his life, which is why he is committed to helping others in need.
They always have hope in our life, you know. The darkness and the light is so together. This is the philosophy of life. You have to find out by yourself. And education is one. If you do not have social background and all other things, you know, you do not have money. Education.
Ampuan's nightmare is over. But not for other shy soldiers who are still fighting in the jungle somewhere. For Asia Calling, this is Kanika Petkao from Bangkok, Thailand.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. With reporters scattered across Asia, freedom of the press is an issue close to our hearts here at Asia Calling. Our dedicated reporters travel to conflict zones in places like Kashmir and Myanmar, putting themselves at risk to bring you the stories of people at the front lines of conflict and repression. Stories that could easily get lost in the turmoil of conflict and power struggles. And they're not the only one putting themselves in the line of danger. Since 2006, over 700 journalists have been killed doing their job. From India, our correspondent Jasvinder Segal spoke with colleagues throughout the region about their lives as journalists and the state of press freedom in Asia.
Tasneem Khalil was an outspoken writer Bangladesh's largest newspaper, the Daily Star. He wrote about extrajudicial killings. That's until he was dragged from his house, thrown into a cell and tortured.
There's no other way I can really describe it other than an insurgency against perceived atheists and free thinkers in Bangladesh. And they are carrying out a series of assassinations.
He is one of dozens of journalists and bloggers attacked in Bangladesh in recent years, and one of hundreds of journalists around the globe who have been persecuted during their job. According to the World Press Freedom Index, released in April, press freedom is in a very serious situation in 72 countries. In almost two-thirds of the countries surveyed, press freedom has deteriorated in the past year. Here in India, we are doing poorly, ranked 136 out of 180 countries in terms of press freedom.
Under this government, Prime Minister has put himself into a kind of cocoon and has kept all journalists at a distance. And that, I think, is a terrible mistake.
That's eminent Indian journalist Tavleen Singh. He says the situation isn't improving under the current government. Journalists in India are increasingly targeted in online smear campaigns, and so self-censorship is growing. Kavita Singh, a 25-year-old journalism student, is aware that as a young journalist, she is entering a new media environment, with journalists now under closer surveillance than ever before.
There is an electronic media monitoring center, which has 200 content editors watching and monitoring over 600 news channels. The government has also created National Media Analytics, which watches everything on the net, like Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, etc. The journalists are categorized as positive, negative, and neutral, which means that the Indian media is not free.
According to Reporters Without Borders, increased surveillance and authoritarian leaders are undermining media freedom in the Asia-Pacific, a region of 34 countries that counts for more than half of the world's population. Under the military junta, press freedom in Thailand has been hit hard over the past 3 years. Wide-reaching new laws now grant ambiguous powers that allow surveillance and detention of journalists and critics.
More and more people have been arrested or faced charges for expressing their thoughts, sharing information, or reporting facts.
Kanikar Pechkau reports for Asia Calling from Bangkok. She's no stranger to the risk of journalism. Earlier this year, she snuck into the front lines of conflict in Myanmar and spoke with rebel leaders. But the situation in Thailand has her worried.
Self-censorship is common for journalists here. Whenever I do reports about this country, I have to too roughly shake every sentence and every word to make sure that I won't be trouble. But it's get harder and harder.
The region's fastest growing power, China, is one of the very worst countries for media freedom. With over 100 journalists and bloggers behind bars, China has more citizen journalists detained than anywhere else in the world.
It's not even it's a cultural issue more than a political issue.
Asia Calling's Abhijan Barua was a reporter for China Radio International for 5 years, and he believes there is a pervasive culture of repression.
It's not just that politically the government controls the media. People's minds have been shaped in a way where they don't have this tendency to ever question anything.
In Pakistan, media faces pressure from a range of vested interests.
There are different groups like the political groups, religious groups, militant groups, and sometimes the security agencies that require the journalists to go for censorship on certain issues.
That's Naeem Sahotra, Asia Calling's Pakistan correspondent. He says media outlets are blackmailed, pressured not to publish certain content with the threat that advertising will be withdrawn. But Naeem says journalists will continue to rail for freedom.
They are still struggling to work independently and to work with full freedom. That still is a far dream, it seems.
For Asia Calling, I'm Jaswinder Sehgal in Jaipur, India.
Afghanistan was once a flourishing country with beautiful cities and plenty of food and water. But geographical constraints, climate change, and decades of war have decimated much of the country. With rivers running dry and temperatures increasing, water has reached a critical shortage. Gail Waziri has this report from Kabul.
I am at the base of Pagman Mountains, where the Kabul River flows. Just 30 years ago, the river was full of water, irrigating the farms and villages of Kabul province. The land was green and lush, and water was plentiful.
The Kabul River was a very nice river and full of clean water before. When I was about 20 years old, during the hot weather, I would swim there.
But now, the river is dry. Most of the farms have gone, and houses have taken their place. Mohammad Yusuf has lived here since he was a boy. He says he has never seen anything like it. The river has almost all dried up now. It is just a dry bed filled with garbage. The only time water flows is the 2 months a year when it rains.
Before, the water came up as high as the street, but now, due to climate change, the water level has dropped and garbage has taken its place.
Because of this climate change, mountain snow melt earlier and earlier every year, and Afghanistan has no reservoir to store this early runoff. By the time the summer heat arrives, the water is gone, just when it's needed most. With less water, drought is increasing, and there are fears half of the country's wells will soon dry up. Kazim Hamayun is chief of planning in Afghanistan Environment Department.
After 1965, Afghanistan was faced with climate change, but during the past few years, the changing climate has become more intense, and there is more damage to the environment. For example, last year there was less rain, and before, there would often be snow on the top of the mountains, even during summer.
Six million people live in Kabul, and 80% of them lack access to safe drinking water, and 95% lack access to improved sanitation facilities. With hardly any clean water flowing down from the mountains, people have been seeking out water from underground sources instead. But now, even that water is polluted. Afghanistan has no wastewater management system. Most people use septic tanks in the sewerage in other wastewater leaks contaminate the wells that people drink from. The contamination, the garbage, decades of war, and chronic poverty is one problem on top of another in Kabul. The head of city's water department, Hamidullah Yalani, says most of Kabul's underground water sources are polluted.
Unfortunately, because of climate change, people have been forced to use underground water, digging their own wells in an unprofessional way. It damages the underground sources of water, and on the other hand, it also drains the Kabul River dry.
Like I said, it is one problem on top of the other.
Most of the sewerage tanker trucks discharged into the river, which also pollutes underground water sources.
Research shows that 25% of deaths among Afghan children under 5 are due to diarrhea. caused by contaminated water and poor sanitation. Muhammad Dawood is a resident of Kabul.
In the past, Kabul weather was very clean and good. It wasn't polluted, and it was colder than it is now. And it would rain more too. Now it is polluted, and it affects people's lives. It's harder to breathe, and there has been an increase in other health complications. And birth deformities have increased.
The rapid rise in Kabul's population is another reason why the quality of water has dropped so drastically. The more people there are, the more resources they consume. Back at the Environment Department, Kazem Hamayun fears that impacts of climate change will make the country more vulnerable to natural disasters in the future.
The water sources of Afghanistan have decreased about 40% and they have dropped very rapidly. We predict there will be natural disasters in the future, such as an increase in floods.
Humayun says there are positive steps globally. The United Nations framework on climate change in the signing of the Paris Agreement. But it's going to take a long time for Afghanistan to recover from the damage that's already been done. And we may never see the lush Greenland of Muhammad Yusuf Qadri's youth again. Faisha Kaling, this is Ghayur Waziri from Kabul, Afghanistan.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced at the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about the show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling and subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.